Welcome to Wisconsin's annual peace rally, sponsored by the Clarence Kalin Chapter 25 Veterans for Peace and Friends of the Lincoln Brigade. Thank you very much for being here today. My name is David Giffey. I'll be your MC today. And the first thing that I want to do is a couple of announcements. They include, and on the chairs when you came in, you may have noticed that there is an announcement of a Veterans for Peace sponsored event August 2nd at the Madison Urban League, way out on near the Beltline on South Park Street. And it's Lisa Gilman's new book called My Music, My War. And I'm sure that'll be a wonderful event. Please plan on attending that. Veterans for Peace, what is it? We're an international organization with more than 120 chapters worldwide. Our mission is the abolition of war. That's a rather ambitious mission. We work to educate ourselves, our families, and our communities about the human and the monetary costs of war. On Saturday, this previous Saturday, 2 days ago, Chapter 25 members and our friends and volunteers installed the Memorial Mile along Atwood Avenue at Olbrich Park as a reminder of the cost of war, the human cost of war. Please take time this week, if you haven't already seen it, to take a look at the Memorial Mile. It will remain in place for a week until next Saturday, June 2nd. Why is Veterans for Peace necessary? Why do we work for peace? And by the way, I'm a veteran of the war in Vietnam, and the further explanation will come about all those things. I've heard people ask and say, rather cynically, I believe, that they question the existence of a peace movement. And I hope that after today and during this rally today, which is a peace rally, that it will become evident that the peace movement is alive and well, even though it's perhaps scorned and ignored in some places. We continue to raise our voices in dissent to U.S. invasions and occupations around the world. So in addition to the human cost of lives and suffering, which is really explained and enumerated by that Memorial Mile, where there's a little simulated grave marker for the American only dead in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it seems to stretch for miles. Well, if we were to add the lives and deaths of the hundreds of thousands of people in other countries, civilians and otherwise, who have died, men, women, children, there wouldn't be room at Olbrich Park for that many markers. All of these killed and wounded and displaced people are victims of wars that are waged in our names, in our names. The cost of wars since 2001 is approaching $6 trillion in monetary costs. The National Priorities Project, which if you haven't already looked at it in the internet, it's a very important and interesting source of information about the cost, the monetary cost of wars, and what could be done with that money. The Pentagon is responsible for approximately half of all federal discretionary spending. That's roughly the accumulated size of the next seven largest military budgets in the world, the human cost and the monetary cost of wars. Those are rather staggering statistics, and they're too common, and they exceed, needless to say, Veterans for Peace budget. Which brings me to this point. I'd like to ask members of Veterans for Peace and their families to stand, please, if you would. And Clarence Kalin, our chapter is named after Clarence Kalin, who was a renowned veteran of the Spanish Civil War. Thank you. And would you remain standing for a moment while I read the names to honor the memories of our fellow Chapter 25 Veterans for Peace who have died in recent years. Clarence Kalin, Joey Camerano, Jim Ellsworth, Sidney Podell, Dr. James Allen, Jeff Goldstein, Charles Sweet, Dr. Eugene Farley, Joel Galswick, John Oliger, Ed Garvey. Thank you very much. At the end of the today's program, you'll be offered a red carnation. We have a bucket of them up here, and I need the bucket back, so don't take it, please. You'll be offered a red carnation to place at the Abraham Lincoln Brigade marker, which is outside. It's one of, I believe, two in the United States that honor the memories of the people who honor the veterans of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, who, like Clarence Kalin, went as volunteers in the late 1930s. Clarence went in 1937 to Spain to fight the fascists before World War II. And Clarence told me one time that he thought it would be peculiar to people who would hear about this because he was a pacifist. And yet he was going off to war. He was compelled to do so. Many of us, myself particularly, I would say, had less noble reasons for going to war, more ignorant and less noble. The war in Vietnam, I feel, was a terrible error, but my presence there was what convinced me of that. So, you'll get a red carnation at the end of the program. You can take it and place it at the grave marker if you wish. And the red carnations internationally have a symbolic purpose. They symbolize resistance to dictators. And they also symbolize May Day celebrations. And they symbolize support for the labor movement. So whatever appeals to you, you have many choices, hopefully all three. We're going to begin our program today with Father David Cooper. I'm getting used to calling him Father David. He's a member of Veterans for Peace, an author, and former Madison police chief. Father David.
Well, it's good to be back here at this important annual event. We've all heard that statement, blessed are the peacekeepers. I mean, we've all heard this, and some of us have tried to live it. Our religious and our philosophic traditions, thank you, ask us to dream about and be that kind of person, peacekeepers, that one day we'll be able to turn our spears into pruning hooks, our swords into plowshares. And many of us come here today, however, as trained warriors. We come from a culture often more comfortable with bombing opponents into oblivion, touting how big our nuclear button is, than doing the difficult work of managing conflict and being an effective peacekeeper. My generation came out of World War II. I was born in 1938, and yes, I am 80 years old. If people tell me that, I will refuse to believe it. But nevertheless, I joined the Marine Reserve as a junior in high school, and as soon as I turned 17 years of age, I joined that, and then the year after when I graduated, I went on active duty. So what did I think I was doing at the time? I thought military service was something every able-bodied then young man should engage in. Why? Because it helped keep peace in the world, we were told. That a free society, that we all should contribute. That we all serve the greater good, and we do this through service to others. So I trained hard as a warrior. I was an expert in weaponry, a teacher of self-defense. I taught bayonet fighting. I was prepared to fight. I was a trained warrior. Just show me the war. After recruit training, I was assigned to the USS Boxer, a World War II era aircraft carrier. And I was soon the captain's orderly and was often on the bridge with the captain of the ship when we were sent to Eniwetok Atoll for the hydrogen bomb tests in the late 1950s. It was there all my warrior training seems futile. I mean, after all, witnessing an aircraft carrier perched on the top of a mushroom cloud certainly diminished one's capacity as being a warrior in the world. So on the bridge of that Boxer, I started thinking about all this and what it was all about. And then I went on to read more about what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki in the works of John Hershey and other authors. And I came to the conclusion that war is a pretty futile effort and that force only complicates things. So this began my walk towards trying to be a peacekeeper. 33 years as a police officer and 21 of them here as your chief of police. And then on to ordination in the Episcopal Church as I started looking at what did I believe and why did I believe it. And it is why I continue to work today and write about things and urge more peaceful behaviors from our nation's police, that they need to shed their dominant role of warrior for that of guardian and peacekeeper. You see, this has sort of become a calling for me again. So I continue to work for peace, and it, of course, first begins inside of us, our lives, our thoughts, our actions, forgiving and being forgiven, being able to listen to those with whom we do not agree, being respectful when others may not be respectful to us, and controlling our desire for revenge and retaliation, and always having to be right. But peacekeeping is more than being religious or spiritual. In fact, you needn't be either. But what you have to do is to hold a value in the dignity and worth of all people. And that means everyone, all creation, and especially those who do not agree with us. And in these times, this is going to be difficult. Today, as always, being a peacekeeper in a warrior society is not easy. It takes courage, and I'll tell you, it is lonely, and it is often despised and rejected work. Nevertheless, peacekeeping is a calling similar to one religious or spiritual. Are you called to do this work? How will you do it? With whom will you ally? And how will you be sustained in this work? You might think about joining Veterans for Peace. You don't have to be a veteran to work for peace, but you need to do something. Can you hold the three P's, the passion, and the persistence, and the patience to do this kind of work? I pray that you will. For my invocation today, I'd like to read a blessing from one of my favorite poets, David White. Just beyond yourself is where you need to be. Half a step into self-forgetting and the rest. Restored by what you'll meet. There is a road always beckoning. When you see the two sides of it, closing together at that far horizon, and deepen the foundations of your own heart at exactly the same time, that's how you know it's the road. It's the road you have to follow. That's how you know it's where you have to go. That's how you know you have to go. That's how you know. Just beyond yourself, it's where you need to be. There's a road always beckoning, the place you need to be. Amen.
He's tall. Thank you, Father David. For many years, this rally has been assisted by the audio skills of Steve Ringwood and Norm Stockwell. I won't mention a former connection to WRT-FM, but there certainly is one, and WRT-FM and others, all of us, are indebted to Wart. Yes, let's hear it for Wart. Norm Stockwell was a longtime staff member at WRT, and he was also a close friend of Clarence Kalin's, and he's now the publisher of the Progressive magazine, and he'll speak in a moment. And I would like to particularly bring to your attention a weekly update, which Norm is now responsible for, and I downloaded this online, and it shows the Memorial Mile. And Norm will speak to us for the next few minutes about a return trip he made to Vietnam late last year. Please welcome Norm Stockwell.
Thanks very much. Before I talk about my trip, I do want to take a moment to remember Laurel Kalin, Clarence Kalin's daughter, who just passed away about a month ago after a long struggle with cancer. And family members tell me there will be a public commemoration of her life later this summer, but a date has not yet been set. So we'll keep people informed about that. So, as David mentioned, I just recently made a trip back to Vietnam to visit the projects there that are being assisted by Madison Quakers Incorporated. Madison Quakers Incorporated for 25 years has been raising funds, much of it from this very community, to help the people of My Lai in Vietnam. And this year was the 50th anniversary of the My Lai massacre. Of course, Vietnam has been very much in the news the last several months between the Ken Burns documentary on public television with all of its shortcomings, and the 50th anniversaries of the Tet Offensive and also the My Lai massacre happening this spring. It's also the 45th anniversary of the Paris peace talks. When I traveled to My Lai this past March, I spent about a week there visiting the different projects that Madison Quakers Incorporated has been funding. I wrote a piece about it, which is in this current issue of the Progressive. I won't read the whole thing, but I'll tell you a couple of the highlights. One is seeing the successes of these funds and the difference that they make for families. And the loan funds are used, it's a revolving loan fund system where a woman in the village is chosen by a committee process to receive a loan fund. They get the loan, they use it to buy a cow. The cow has a baby. The baby grows up, they sell the baby cow, they pay back the loan. It's been a tremendously successful project all the way around. And the difference that this little bit of money makes in the lives of people there, helping them to raise their families, to remodel their homes, and so on. Other projects that Madison Quakers Inc. have been involved in include the building of a primary school right down the road from the site of the My Lai massacre, and that school has three buildings now. The first one built in 2000, the second one in 2004, and the third one in 2008. I was there for the groundbreaking of the third building. And they have 600 students and 40 teachers. Madison Quakers Inc. also helps to purchase bicycles. The bicycles are used to enable kids in rural villages to be able to get to these schools. And then they also sponsor scholarship programs, many of them going to the children of Agent Orange victims who are suffering from the hereditary effects of that dioxin poisoning that the United States left in that country. Also wells and for clean drinking water and other construction projects, and things called compassion houses, which are homes that are built specifically for the victims of Agent Orange, who are often suffering in various ways and unable to take care of themselves. So those are some of the kinds of things. Over $200,000 in loan funds have been made over the last 25 years. And this year, Mike Boehm, the director of those projects, was awarded an honorary award from the Women's Union of Quang Ngai Province, where these projects are going on. And what they said there, the woman who's in charge of the Women's Union said, the vice chair of the Women's Union said, "The Women's Union sees many foreign organizations. They come and they go, but Madison Quakers stays, and our friendship will last long." The image of My Lai, for us here in the United States, so much of our images of Vietnam are sort of frozen in time. But for the people of Vietnam, they're moving forward. They're rebuilding and have been rebuilding for the last few decades, their society, their country. I took the train through the length of Vietnam when I was there, and you can just see all of these projects, rural electrification projects and housing projects and so on that are going on. But as Mike said when we were there, My Lai was chosen for these projects because of the enormous debt that's owed by the United States to the people of this region. "We must always remember the past," he said, "so we do not repeat those mistakes. But I'm also looking to the future, and I see the future in the faces of the children of My Lai." Thank you.
Speaking of young faces, it's good to see young faces here today, and I hope that in future years there'll be lots more, not only sitting where you are, but standing where I am in the coming years. Thanks, Norm. 11 years ago, Chapter 25 began offering cash scholarships to high school students. And to begin a brief segment of our program today about those scholarships, I'm going to ask Paul McMahon if he'd come up, because Paul has been operating and in charge of the Madison Scholarship event. So please, Paul McMahon, if you would.
Okay, how close? This close. I really want to thank David Giffey, who's inspirational in all of what he does in the rural schools, and he'll explain those. I handle the Madison High Schools, and it's pretty much on autopilot. I have a lot of help from representatives, counselors in those schools, the five Madison Public High Schools. That's where we offer them. This year, I just want to introduce the Madison winner, Diana Nava. Have I got that right, Diana? I'd like to have her stand. And what we do in Madison is we offer a $1,000 cash scholarship to go to MATC. It's a great way to start a college education, trades, whatever, two-year, four-year. You've probably read about the connection between the university and MATC and the agreement. So anyway, I'd like to introduce the young lady who won this year's essay on why violence is never the answer. She wrote a wonderful essay. Her name is Diana Nava. Diana, would you stand, please? Good job. Diana brought members of her family here, and I would like to have her introduce them, please. And just introduce, and if you want to say a few words, that's fine too. Okay.
Thank you very much, Diana, family, Paul, and all the people that contributed to the scholarship fund. As Paul mentioned, we also offer scholarships in rural high school districts. Spring Green, which is called River Valley, it has one of those generic names. Richland Center, Muscadet has the generic name of Riverdale, which is meaningless to most of us. Dodgeville, Boscobel, and Baraboo. The scholarship program is named after our late friend and longtime Veterans for Peace member, Dr. Jim Allen, whom some of you may have known. To qualify, students are asked to write an essay of 500 to 700 words on the topic, Why I Believe War and Violence is Not the Answer. Over the years since the scholarship program began, we have received a total of approximately 200 essays from rural schools, many of them, which I hope you realize is an incredible outpouring of sentiment and work on the parts of the students. In some of those schools, those small schools, where maybe 60 or 70 students graduate every year, as much as 15% of the senior graduating class in some years has written an essay on that subject. It's a victory, I believe, for the peace movement and for Veterans for Peace to receive that many essays on a subject of peace and nonviolence in this world, which is, I would claim, known for war and violence. The winning essays in other high schools this year were written by Lily Scallon in Boscobel, Nicole Erdman in Dodgeville, Miles Stotts, Baraboo, Garrett Prem in River Valley, and I'll be awarding the final essay of 2018 in Richland Center on Wednesday, so I won't announce his or her name because it's supposed to be a surprise. And we give high-quality chocolate bars to the kids that don't win because they deserve something, we feel. We congratulate all the winners and all the other deserving essay writers. And Paul mentioned the process that is involved. If you notice up here behind me, it's hard to avoid. This is the visual display that I use when I go into high schools counter-recruiting, visiting those schools that you mentioned. Nancy, my wife, and I live in Iowa County, near between Arena and Spring Green. So I visit those schools two or three times a year in that we have cultivated this scholarship program in. I would like to say, however, that we're not succeeding because there are 420 some high schools in Wisconsin, and we deal with seven. So there's a lot of work left to be done, as Clarence Kalin was noted to say. Our featured speaker on your program, we've had some notable speakers over the years at this event, and this event has been going on more years than I can remember, or than I can count properly. And our speaker this year is certainly among the most notable. Alfred McCoy, historian and author of In the Shadows of the American Century, that's his most recent book, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. His expertise is widely recognized to include U.S. foreign policy, colonial empires in Southeast Asia, illicit drug trafficking, CIA covert operations, and modern Philippine history. He will draw upon his most recent book, In the Shadows of the American Century, to explain the effect of a declining U.S. hegemony in the world. Please say hello and welcome Al McCoy.
How's the sound? Is that okay? Okay. I'm going to talk about the eclipse of the U.S. empire and the processes of micromilitarism and the likely decline of democracy that might come from this process. After 70 years at the apex of global power, we are coming to the end of the so-called American century, and we are entering a time of transition when the most powerful empire in the history of the world is beginning a protracted and what may prove a painful decline. So on this Memorial Day, when we honor our veterans and reflect on the meaning of their sacrifice, we can pause to take the measure of this historical moment, both what we have won and what might be lost. This impending decline might be a unique event in American history, but from a world perspective, these imperial transitions from one empire to the next have happened over the past 600 years at least once every century. Indeed, over the past two centuries, we've seen the rise and fall of many empires. By 1815, 200 years ago, Napoleon's continental empire had collapsed. In the 1820s, Spain lost its Latin American empire. A century after that, Britain was so exhausted by its victory in World War I that the end of its global empire was preordained. With the end of World War II, the Japanese empire in Asia, the world's largest ever, and the Nazi empire in Europe, the first to control that continent, were defeated. In the two decades following World War II, the half dozen European overseas colonial empires that once ruled nearly half of humanity dissolved with blinding speed. More recently, the Soviet Empire in Eastern Europe and Central Asia imploded during the early 1990s, setting off shockwaves that are still reverberating in Europe, Asia, and worldwide. And now, at the dawn of the 21st century, it seems to be our turn to experience the slow, painful decline of our once lofty status as history's most powerful empire. Now, looking back over the past two centuries, these imperial transitions are often marked by two troubling trends that represent, in this historical moment, a potential threat to the continued vitality of American democracy. First, dying empires often plunge into costly, sometimes disastrous, military misadventures in a desperate attempt to recover their fading imperial glory. And second, these empires, these fading empires, have a tendency during the trauma of this transition towards political extremism, whether populism or fascism, as the painful loss of empire demoralizes the citizenry. So let's begin by looking at something that historians call micromilitarism. And I'll explain what that term means. With foreign policy crises on the boil from Ukraine and Syria to Afghanistan and from the South China Sea to South Korea, there are countless opportunities for an American president to launch a misguided military intervention in a bid to recover fading U.S. global power, the kind of a disastrous war that historians of empire call micromilitarism. Now, as their power fades, modern empires often plunge into these micromilitary misadventures in a misguided, even foolhardy bid to recover their fading imperial power through a kind of bold military masterstroke, a genius move that's going to recover, bring back all that faded power, and intimidate would-be enemies, and instead bring hemorrhaging expenditures and humiliating defeats. Let's look at what history has to teach us. First of all, let's start with Spain. In its long imperial retreat that lasted actually for 300 years, Spain provides a good example of such micromilitarism, both the desperate bid to recover fading glory and the domestic political consequences. After losing its last colonies to the United States in the Spanish-American War of 1898, Spain plunged into a national depression, and it began to try and recover its faded glory by expanding out of those small coastal enclaves it had along the Moroccan coast. And it began in the 1920s to fight a desperate war in the Atlas Mountains against the Berber tribes called the Rif War. And in one of the early battles of this war, virtually the entire Spanish expeditionary force of 20,000 men was slaughtered in the field of battles, one of the most disastrous defeats suffered by any power in history. Nonetheless, despite that horrific defeat and the slaughter of an unimaginable number of soldiers, Madrid clung desperately to the desolate, profitless wastelands of Spanish Morocco. Dispatching the Spanish Foreign Legion under General Francisco Franco and mobilizing every possible military resource for a protracted war of pacification against the Berber guerrillas, a war that featured history's first sustained aerial bombardment with poison gas. The Atlas Mountains are still tainted with that poison today, and the world's first successful amphibious landing. In a very real sense, Generalissimo Franco's 40 years of fascist dictatorship arose from the ashes of empire, taking form in Morocco and full flight when his Army of Africa crossed the straits into Spain from Africa and launched a bloody civil war against the Spanish Republic in 1936. Another telling example of micromilitarism was Britain's invasion of the Suez Canal in 1956 that offers insights into the possible future of U.S. global power. Now, after a difficult recovery from World War II, Britain was enjoying in the mid-1950s almost total employment. They had as close as anybody's ever gotten to absolutely full employment. They had lucrative international investments, and they were conducting a carefully managed decolonization that preserved much of British power. And Britain enjoyed the prestige of the pound sterling, its currency, as the world's global reserve currency. Then came the devastating Suez Crisis. Now, just as the Panama Canal was for Americans of an older generation a shining example of this nation's global prowess, so British conservatives treasured the Suez Canal as a vital lifeline to British oil refineries in Iran. When Egypt's President Nasser electrified the Arab world by nationalizing the Suez Canal in 1956, Britain's conservative Prime Minister Anthony Eden erupted with egotism, bluster, and outrage, first ordering British intelligence to assassinate Nasser, and when those attempts failed, launching an invasion by 300,000 British, French, and Israeli forces to secure the Suez Canal. After a secret meeting in Paris with British, French, and Israeli leaders that was concealed, by the way, from Washington, the Israelis attacked Sinai, their jets sweeping the skies, their tanks smashing Egyptian armor, and the paratroopers under Ariel Sharon advancing close to the canal. Then, on the pretext of restoring stability, in the midst of this unexpected war, surprise, surprise, we had no idea, the British and French sent an armada of 5 aircraft carriers that just happened to be, by the way, pulled out of mothballs, gassed up, loaded with troops and jets and ready to go on the drop of a dime. But nonetheless, it was an unexpected war. And those aircraft carriers shot down 200 Egyptian aircraft and landed commandos to occupy much of the canal zone. Now, as the Anglo-French invasion smashed the Egyptian military, killing 3,000 troops and capturing 30,000 more, Nasser came up with a simple device. He simply loaded rocks into 40 rusting ships at the mouth of the Suez Canal and sank them and blocked the canal. So the British and French force had nothing of any value. With Washington opposed and London's finances trembling at the brink of financial collapse, Great Britain was forced to accept an humiliating defeat. Indeed, in the aftermath of this diplomatic disaster, the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, launched the world's first ever fiscal bailout, not for the Mexican peso, but for the British pound, which was at the brink of collapse. And that took a $1 billion bailout, which, by the way, back then was an enormous amount of money. And that effectively ended the British pound sterling's lead role as a major global reserve currency. The author of this extraordinary debacle was Sir Anthony Eden, a child of privilege and a rebel within his own conservative party, whose career offers some uncanny parallels with our own President Donald Trump. Led by Eden's delusions of omnipotence, into this unimaginably misbegotten operation, the once mighty British Lion now seemed to be, to the whole world, a toothless circus animal that would henceforth roll over whenever Washington cracked the whip. Now, when historians look back on America's long-forgotten global empire a century from now, they may add up all the damage from the Iraq invasion to characterize President George Bush's decision as a similar sort of micro-military misadventure that accelerated the decline of U.S. global power. Now, back in 2003, if we can remember that far back, the Bush administration told us that this war would cost just $80 billion, you know, bargain buying, I'll have two, thank you, pay for itself in oil profits, spark a golden age of democracy that would sweep across the entire Middle East, and secure a bastion in Iraq for the projection of American power throughout this troubled region. But if we add up all the damage that war has done in the last 15 years, it begins to look less like a geopolitical masterstroke and more like a micro-military disaster that is corroding U.S. global power. The damage from this operation includes U.S. casualties numbering 4,424 dead, 31,952 wounded, and 4,839 suicides by active duty soldiers, and many more by Iraq veterans over the past 13 years. Iraqi civilian casualties are estimated at a low of 123,000 dead and a high of 655,000 killed. We also witnessed the utter devastation of the country's major cities, including that great center of civilization in the Middle East, Mosul, and lesser cities, Ramada and Fallujah, in the aftermath of the disastrous ISIS offensive in 2014. We've also seen an incessant torrent of refugees, including 3 million internally displaced Iraqis, 2 million more in neighboring countries, and as the war spilled into neighboring Syria, an estimated 3 million displaced and 5 million more fleeing the country, including nearly a million to Europe. We have seen continuous U.S. military operations for the past 15 years that are likely to continue into the foreseeable future. And we've seen a corrupt Iraqi democracy that has produced just last month the election of a radical party led by the anti-American Shia militant Muqtada al-Sadr. All of this has destabilized the wider Middle East, diminished U.S. international prestige, and arguably damaged the quality of American democracy. Earlier this year, after surveying 134 countries worldwide, the Gallup polling organization reported that worldwide approval of U.S. leadership has plunged from 48% approval in 2016 to a historic record low of 30%, which is a notch below China at 31% and way below West Germany, or Germany, at 41%. The direct costs of the Iraq war are $757 billion, and the indirect costs are now estimated at $3.5 trillion, which is equivalent to 20% of the entire U.S. economy in 2016. The Watson Institute at Brown University estimates the total cost of the global war on terror, a figure that David Giffey just gave us earlier, at a mind-boggling $5.6 trillion, that's trillion with a T, a vast capital diverted from domestic investments needed for this country to remain competitive in world markets. And if the Iraq war does not qualify as micromilitarism, then present or future American presidents might find ample opportunity for such devastating military misadventures in Iraq, Syria, Korea, or the South China Sea. Next, let's consider quickly the possible consequences of U.S. decline. Now, we need to entertain, I think, a difficult, even uncomfortable question. Why should any of us, liberal or conservative, who harbors doubts about America's global power, be concerned about its accelerating decline? Why not just raise our glasses and all toast, good riddance to U.S. global power, we're not going to miss you at all. Okay? That's the the default, particularly in this group. I would expect that we could just all jump up and raise those imaginary glasses right now and knock back that imaginary champagne. Too bad about that imaginary part there. Anyway, but let's just pause for a second. Let's consider this question. For the past 70 years, Washington has used its extraordinary strength to build a world order grounded in what I call a delicate duality that juxtaposed two contradictory attributes. On the one hand, an idealistic community of sovereign nations equal under the rule of international law, joined, on the other hand, tensely, even tenuously, to an American power grounded in the realpolitik of raw U.S. military and economic strength. Now, on the raw power side of this duality, at the end of World War II, Washington circled Eurasia with hundreds of military bases to confine its Cold War enemies, China and Russia, behind the Iron Curtain. The U.S. was an industrial powerhouse that dominated the world economy. Its empowered diplomats negotiated defense pacts and trade deals that greatly advantaged America. And its CIA operatives maneuvered relentlessly in the shadow lands of global power to topple neutral or hostile governments via coups and covert operations. Washington, as we all know, eventually won the Cold War, but its tough tactics entailed some heavy costs. Brutal military dictatorships across Asia and Latin America, millions of dead in Indochina, and devastated societies in Central Asia, Central America, and Southern Africa. Simultaneously, however, the U.S. victory in World War II also brought a surge of citizen idealism as millions of American veterans returned home hopeful that their sacrifice and that of their comrades had not only defeated fascism, but also won a more peaceful world. At the end of World War II, therefore, Washington also invested much of its power and prestige in forming something new, forming an international community that would promote peace and shared prosperity through permanent institutions, the United Nations, the World Bank, the General Agreement on Trades and Tariffs, and the World Health Organization. To promote its ideal, which is a strong American ideal that's been characteristic of U.S. global power since we first stepped onto the world stage at the second International Hague Peace Conference in 1907. To promote this ideal of a world ordered by the rule of law, Washington helped establish the International Court of Justice under the UN Charter and would later promote both human rights and women's rights. Now, if the world experiences a slow, peaceful transition away from U.S. hegemony, then the subsequent global order might, just might, maintain the liberal international institutions like the UN, the World Health Organization, the World Bank, and the International Court that, dare we say, yes, I do, represent the best of this country's values. Now, if by contrast, the world experiences an erratic, unplanned, pell-mell American retreat from the world stage, and the parallel rise of more autocratic hegemonic powers, China and Russia, then we will likely witness a harsher world order based on realpolitik and commercial advantage, with scant attention to human rights, women rights, and the rule of law. More broadly, whether this will be a peaceable transition, akin to the kind of amicable imperial handover across the Atlantic from Britain to America in the 1950s, or whether it will be a violent eruption like the Napoleonic Wars or World War I, whichever one it is, or something in between, this ongoing shift in the balance of power bears close and careful watching. And from everything I've learned since I started graduate school in history studying empires nearly 50 years ago, I think we can count on one thing. This transition will be transformative, perhaps even traumatically so, impacting the lives of almost every American. Thank you.
Well, here's a imaginary toast to Professor McCoy. Thank you very much. That was wonderful. As I mentioned, we've had an array of speakers at this event, and I think today we have more than enough to contemplate as we go home. And I would also like to encourage all of you, and Professor McCoy's family is here also, I think. Hello, yes. That we need to really encourage young people to join us, more young people. I think we're doing well now, and we have in the past through a variety of means, but there is a definite need for young people to stand up and join in the peace movement and to join us in contemplating the end of hegemony, as Professor McCoy has spoken about. To end our rally, peace rally, we would very much like all of you to take a carnation, go over and contemplate the memorial marker, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade memorial marker. It's not as cool out there as it is in here, but you still have to leave. While you're leaving, while you're exiting, Sean Michael Dargan, who is our faithful bagpipe player, will be playing a dirge for whatever purposes you have in mind as you take the carnation over and contemplate the marker. Thank you very much. Please, thank you for coming today. Visit the Memorial Mile and work for peace and put us in touch with young people.